You've been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning, the views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Happy Monday and welcome again to your independent, non-corporate, alternative media radio program for Central Wisconsin, The Mike Cannon Show. Each Monday, starting at 2 p.m., we try to bring you voices and views produced by other not-for-profit and or community-based radio stations. This way you can hear what is really going on in the world, not just some spoon-fed news brought to you by whichever of the five mega-corporations who own most of the airways out there want you to know about. Before we go on to this week's Mike Cannon Show, a 10-minute piece about the importance of independent media produced by the group of Ground Zero Radio Project.
Welcome to Ground Zero Quick Takes. I'm Clyde Lewis. What is the purpose of independent thought? Better yet, what is the purpose of independent media? Why is independent media vital to getting the word out about the lies that are being told by the mainstream media? It is vital to generate new ideas and to change minds. Independent media is the public printing press, and there are many people in the elite who believe that generating new ideas and bringing about new action is a threat to their power.
There is a certain social process which is known and very visible, but perhaps not acknowledged as much as it should be. It is that one where a new idea, or an old one in new form, is accepted by a minority, while the majority are shouting treason, rubbish, kook, communist, capitalist, or whatever is the term of abuse valued in that society. And they develop this idea, at first probably in secrecy or in semi-secrecy, and then more and more visibly, with more and more support, until, guess what? This seditious, impossible, wrong-headed idea becomes what is known as received opinion, and is loved and valued by the majority.
Look, people, you heard it on the radio. You seen it on a TV show.
Without independent thought or media, we begin to see a problem arise. Without various forms of media and opinion in that media, we run the risk of a small group shaping the consensus reality. The group mind is given a phony left and right split, alternately loosening up society through the tolerant left, followed by the reactionary gains through the right, with the advance of the police state and tyrannical control coming up the middle. Independent media should strive to become the equilibrium in the consensus reality. But by continuously reporting the false alternatives of left against right, independent media can lose its punch. And while it is caught up in the left wing versus right wing, the red state against blue state, we fail to understand the fascist state and how both the right and the left are responsible for its arrival.
Big Brother is listening. No, really. He is listening and he's tracking every phone call that you make. That shocking revelation revealed today when the details of yet another secret government spying program were revealed in a front page screamer in the USA Today. Now for liberals who have long been going against almost all of these issues to defend privacy, the news has to be disturbing. But no less so for conservatives who have fought national ID cards and gun registration for years out of fear of big government. Now, whatever you consider yourself, friends, you should be afraid. You should be very afraid. With over 200 million Americans targeted, this domestic spying program is so widespread, it is so random, it is so far removed from focusing on Al-Qaeda suspects that the president was talking about today, that it's hard to imagine any intelligence program in U.S. history being so susceptible to abuse. You know, I served on the Judiciary Committee and the Armed Services Committee in Congress for 4 years, and no program I studied while using security clearances ever came close to the scope of this massive spy program. It is dangerous, it breaks FCC laws, and it endangers all Americans' right to privacy. But you know what? The villains in this spy program are pretty easy to target, almost as easy as your phone records. First, you have the president, who's shown that he will break laws if they get in his way of spying. Second, Democratic leaders, they complain now, but where were they? They reviewed the program. Why no protests? Don't hold your press conferences now, Nancy Pelosi. Tell us about it when you learn about it. And finally, the phone companies, who actually profited from the government reading all of your phone bills. They should be sued, and their CEOs fired. Hey, memo to the president and congressional leaders who signed off on this lousy program. We don't trust you anymore. We don't trust you with our phone bills. We don't trust you with our bank records. We don't trust you with our medical histories. From now on, if you want to look at Americans' private records, get a damn search warrant.
Now, the plan to eavesdrop for the American people is nothing new. The mainstream media makes it sound like it's all George W. Bush's idea. Ronald Reagan wanted to do it way back when he was president. George H.W. Bush was all for it, too. And Bill Clinton used the controversial Echelon program to spy on other businesses so he could help his friends make more money. Back then, it was all done with the help of the CIA.
The men and women of the CIA are the eyes and ears of the free world. You are the tripwire.
CIA is a state-sponsored terrorist association. You don't look at people as human beings. They're nothing but pieces on the chessboard.
Secrecy in this work is essential. Achievements and triumphs can seldom be advertised. Shortcomings and failures often are advertised.
No one really knows all the things that CIA does. They pretty much have carte blanche, and they have an enormous amount of money.
Yeah, maybe I'm overly naive, but I don't see what would be wrong with that.
Now, we need more intelligence, not less. We must not diminish our intelligence.
The CIA is not really an intelligence agency. It's a covert action agency.
The CIA has been involved in assassination and torture behind the scenes all through its history.
The Cold War is over, but many new dangers have taken its place. The decisive advantage United States intelligence provides this country is therefore as important as it has ever been.
Now, America must prepare for its new CIA. Or is it just the old CIA up to its same old tricks?
General Mike Hayden, the president's choice to head the CIA, kept making the rounds on Capitol Hill today, insisting everything the National Security Agency does is both legal and briefed to Congress. But Republican Senator Chuck Hagel rattled off all the questions Hayden still has to answer about reports NSA is poring over the records of trillions of phone calls made by law-abiding citizens.
Why did they do it? Who did it? What's the end product? What are the consequences? What could happen? Who controls it? Who sees this information? Explain to us how this, in fact, helps fight terrorism.
The most baffling thing of all is how the mainstream media is making this all sound brand new. It has been speculated for years that the CIA and the NSA worked in tandem to spy on the American people. The topic has been written about by several authors and has been presented by radio commentators like Jeff Rentz and Alex Jones. Ground Zero had reported on the Echelon program during the Clinton administration and exposed that the Clinton administration was involved in spying on the American people through the use of computers. Danny Casolaro, an independent reporter, wrote a book about the illegal spying of other countries through a program called InsLaw. Danny Casolaro was writing a book called The Octopus, but was silenced after he was found dead in his hotel room. His death was termed a suicide, however. Casolaro had reported before he died that he was going to be a target for murder. None of this was reported in the mainstream media. In fact, it was all labeled conspiracy theory. Now, for the record, Ground Zero has never really endorsed any particular conspiracy theory. We've only reported what seems to be ignored by the mainstream media. And for this reason, Ground Zero has been called a conspiracy theory news organization, spinning paranoid news from questionable sources. It needs to be realized that in a time where a government is paranoid and big business is paranoid, there seems to be an effort to cover up nefarious activities and deliver disinformation.
Schoolroom Rockies, back on the block with conspiracy theory rock. It's a mediaopoly, a mediaopoly. The whole media is controlled by a few corporations. That's deregulation by the FCC.
You mean Disney, Fox, Westinghouse, and good old GE?
They own networks from CBS to CNBC.
They can use them to say whatever they please and put down the opinions of anyone who disagrees.
Or stuff about PCBs.
What are PCBs?
They come from electric power plants built by Westinghouse and GE.
They can give you lots of cancer that can hurt your body.
But on network TV, you rarely hear anything bad about the nuclear industry.
Like when Westinghouse was sued for fraud?
Which time?
GE made defective bolts, it was an unreported crime. Or when it was boycotted for operating nuclear bomb plants just to squeeze a dime.
That's a footnote, by the way.
A footnote protects you from folks who doubt what you say. Now maybe the voices in my head will go away.
But the big shots don't care. They're all sitting pretty thanks to corporate welfare.
What's that now?
They get billions in subsidies from the government. It's supposed to create jobs, but that's not how it's spent. They use tax and soft money to support congressmen who will over weapons programs again and again and let them dump toxic waste where the young ones play.
ING made the bullets that shot JFK.
You contribute to this chain every time you buy a product sponsored on this show.
That's what NBC doesn't want you to know. Till the next time.
Always remember, history is written by the victors. Or, it's written by those who have enough money to change it. A very key aspect of perpetuating a conspiracy is the use of disinformation or lying to distract or mislead the public.
Switch your viewpoint.
Powerful illusion.
You get a chip.
Switch your viewpoint.
Delusional.
Implanted in you. You get a
switch
chip.
Switch your viewpoint.
Implanted.
Paranoid.
Implanted in you.
Delusional. Paranoid conspiracy wackos.
Big Brother is listening. Big Brother is listening.
Switch your viewpoint. There are no absolutes. Turn to some different things. Remember that whatever they think is right, even if it isn't. Switch your viewpoint. There are no absolutes. Turn to some different things. Remember that whatever they think is right, even if it isn't.
Operator, how may I direct your call?
Can you hear me now? Good.
You've been listening to Ground Zero Quick Takes.
And now, the man who refuses to ease media ownership rules, Mike Cannon.
As you just heard, the importance of independent media is so very crucial in fighting against the rising tide of fascism in this country. We can complain about the obvious influence of corporations, like the rise in the all-hate AM radio stations, and the melding of Fox News with the White House, as demonstrated by their anchors becoming the administrative spokespeople. However, what is perhaps even worse is what the left thinks is a more fair and balanced approach to the way of thinking, like NPR or Wisconsin public radio stations, as some kind of counter to the corporate domination of the right. And although it is well documented and well discussed on the Mike Cannon Show, the marriage between corporations, our government, and the media, today heap criticism on our supposed left, the NPR liberals. As NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio comes under more and more right-wing pressure, their standards and rationale for programming become more and more corporate and more government-friendly. First, we look at NPR nationally, and we see the gross example after example of NPR's knuckling under pressure to be more, quote, balanced, unquote. The most obvious example has been how Lebanon and Israeli bombing is covered. NPR now claims that they strive to cover both sides by interviewing families whose houses have been hit by rockets from Hezbollah or bombs dropped by U.S.-supplied Israeli warplanes. Cover them equally, although Palestine and Lebanon has been suffering from much more in total numbers of deaths in the recent fighting, and ignoring the long, long history of repression by Israel and the random bombing and bulldozing of Palestinian homes for years. NPR even ignores the comments of the largest Jewish newspaper in America, The Ford, whose called attention to the moderate voices of the Jews have not been heard. Even their editor last week claimed that their striving for balance is ignoring the fact that Lebanon and Palestine have suffered much, much more deaths and destruction than the Israeli side. Again, this is from the editor of the largest Jewish newspaper here in the United States, The Forward. It should be no surprise that Fox News and our all-hate AM radio station here in town act as if all things have been equal, with equal coverage and nothing but sympathetic, quote, anti-terrorism, unquote, pro-Israeli points of view. But why is NPR acting like corporate media, too? Not only is NPR giving, quote, equal balance, unquote, to an unequal situation, but has a nightly international news program that starts out with Voices of Israel, but for the next 6 hours they run the show, they never ever give voices to any Palestinian reporters. So I ask you, why do you think NPR is liberal? Now I know what you're thinking. At least NPR liberals here in Wisconsin can claim that the Wisconsin Public Radio is not biased towards corporate-like news. Ignoring the fact that they allow NPR news programming to dominate Wisconsin Public Radio, pervasively swinging information to a pro-corporate, pro-Israeli line, let's look at Wisconsin Public Radio recent programming changes as well to see where the biases really lie. Last week, a long-running show, Lush Show, was taken off the 11 p.m. Sunday night lineup on Wisconsin Public Radio without comment from its liberal supporters, quote, members, unquote, before the decision was made. The reason given by Wisconsin Public Radio, as per their own website, is as following, and I quote it here exactly from their website. In January, we invited the entire Wisconsin Public Radio staff to evaluate all of our programming according to 19 criteria. The show received a poor evaluation based on 3 of those criteria. It does not meet Wisconsin Public Radio technical standards. It does not provide adequate political balance. It does not properly address Wisconsin Public Radio mission. We also noted that Le Show was reaching an extremely small audience. We are not receiving any audience reaction, positive or negative. We believe that the airtime should be devoted to higher quality programming that has a broader appeal. So that was the reasons given by Wisconsin Public Radio. 3 of the 19 Wisconsin Public Radio standards Le Show supposedly did not meet. Not meeting Wisconsin Public Radio technical standards was one of them. The show is perhaps one of the best produced, certainly well footnoted and documented newsy shows on Wisconsin Public Radio. And it cannot be said that it is not as well produced, technically, as any other live shows like Prairie Home Companion or What Do You Know is. So no one is sure what technical standards they did not live up to. They also claim that the show is not politically balanced. Again, the show does rip into the Bush administration, but no more than any other shows like Prairie Home Companion or What Do You Know or Wait, Don't Tell Me did this past weekend, which is nothing but a bunch of humor and ripping on the Bush administration. So much for the number 2 reason of 3 reasons given. Another reason given was it did not properly address Wisconsin Public Radio mission, whatever that means. Again, the same, quote, mission, unquote, concern should be applied to the above-mentioned list as well. Lastly, it is said that they feel it reaches a small audience. Well, perhaps placing it at 11 p.m. on a Sunday night had something to do with that issue. Let's put Prairie Home Companion onto that time slot and see how many people stay up and listen to that show as well. So what is the real reasons for taking off the show? Well, one might be that it is embarrassing to Wisconsin Public Radio that the reports of the show, in a very funny way, talks about that Wisconsin Public Radio never talks about. The show has reported on items after item that Wisconsin Public Radio is either late on to cover or just never does cover. Many of these reports are an embarrassment to our government and corporations that fund Wisconsin Public Radio. Tuning into the show was the only Wisconsin Public Radio show that ever covered items that you will find on any alternative media press. So the show is a threat and an embarrassment to Wisconsin Public Radio and its sponsors, and more so a threat to Wisconsin NPR liberals and how they think of themselves as being well-informed, when what they really get is a lighter version of corporate news items like the pro-Israeli spin of late. Wisconsin Public Radio has yet to answer any inquiries into what scientific methodology they've used in making these bold statements about biases, balance, and technical standards. Why? Because they are best subjective. And by Wisconsin Public Radio standards, the show is a threat. So in my opinion, yet one more reason to listen to unfiltered non-corporate alternative media and give up on supporting, with your tax dollars, corporations and the funding of spin machines that support them, like NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. By supporting NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, you're supporting the corporations and the spin they want you to hear. If you think you can handle the truth, then I thank you now for tuning into this, your only non-corporate media source for Central Wisconsin, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week you will get real reports, and since I am a non-paid volunteer, I don't have to be married to corporations and can give you the unfiltered truth. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
You are indeed listening right now to the only independent media radio program for Central Wisconsin, the Mike Cannon Show. Each week we bring you non-corporate voices from around the country and the world. This week is no exception, as we bring you a show produced out of Canada called World Report, giving you a breakdown about the Near East War. After that, we'll bring you a short piece from Gov Parish of Eat the State fame, and then on to this week's Iraq body count. By the way, last month, according to the Baghdad morticians, over 1,000 civilians died each day in Baghdad alone. Yep, over 3,000 civilians killed last month in Baghdad alone. Now, I'm not a conspiracy nut, but isn't it a good thing that another war is on the table? This way we can't hear about all the ugly news, like the continuing torture of Iraqi detainees by U.S. military personnel, which report came out last week, and all those ugly civilian deaths. Oh, too ugly. Let's think about something else. Shall we, like the poor Israelis or American Idol? Now, there's real news. By the way, if you have any questions or comments about the show, well, just keep them to yourself. Or better yet, write me. I dare you. I give you the truth, you should take the dare and write me. And you can do that by writing The Mike Cannon Show at hotmail.com. That's all one word, The Mike Cannon Show at hotmail.com. And as always, thanks for tuning in. Up next, World Report.
Last Wednesday, Hezbollah crossed the UN blue line in southern Lebanon, killed 3 Israeli soldiers, captured 2 others, and demanded the release of Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. Hezbollah's attack broke the UN rules in southern Lebanon. Geir Pedersen, the senior UN official in Lebanon, called it a violent breach of the blue line. It provided the occasion for Israel to open up a second front in Lebanon, parallel to the similar operation that has been delivering air and artillery strikes for the last couple of weeks in Gaza. Writing from his home in Beirut, Robert Fisk describes how he could hear the jets all night long, quote, whispering high above the Mediterranean. It lasted for hours, he says, little fireflies that were watching Beirut, waiting for dawn, perhaps, because it was then that they descended. He writes that they came first to the little village of Dwer, near Nabatea in southern Lebanon, where an Israeli plane dropped a bomb onto a home of a Shia Muslim cleric. He was killed. So was his wife. So were 8 of his children. Also writing from Beirut, The Guardian's longtime correspondent David Hurst lamented that Lebanon had been plunged back into the role it endured for a quarter century and more, that of hapless arena for other people's wars, as well as pawn in the ambitions and machinations of regional players far more powerful than itself. From Jerusalem, Haaretz correspondent Zvi Barel didn't see it that way. He accused Lebanese commentators of being far from attributing to any Lebanese government the ability to disarm Hezbollah or to deploy its forces along the southern border. Therefore, he concludes that all eyes are turned to the secret talks between Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, and less so to the Security Council deliberations. Rami Khoury, a regular contributor to Beirut's English-language Daily Star, wasn't ready to let the U.S. off the hook so easily. Quote, "You need to understand the relationship among four pairs of actors to grasp the meaning of the escalating attacks by Hamas and Hezbollah and Israel," he says. "The four pairs are Hamas and Hezbollah, the Palestinian and Lebanese governments, Syria and Iran, Israel and the United States." Simplistically, U.S. President George W. Bush has depicted this latest round of war as a clash between good and evil, while the Israeli government has tried to blame Palestinians and Lebanese, who only want to make war, against a peace-loving Israel. The more nuanced and complex reality is that all the actors in the four pairs collectively play a role in the ongoing fighting, as we witness the culmination of four decades of failed policies that have kept the Middle East tense, angry, and violent. End quote. On his way to the G8 meeting in St. Petersburg, Prime Minister Stephen Harper told reporters, quote, "I think Israel's response under the circumstances has been measured," end quote. From the reports we get here, you would never guess how little agreement there is about the details. Fisk speculates that prisoner swaps is probably all that will come of this and points out that such exchanges between Israel and Lebanon have a long history. Fisk concludes that the Lebanese and Israelis know how this cruel game is played. How many have to die before the swaps begin is a more important question. Peace activist and former left-wing member of Knesset Uri Avneri insists that the real aim is to change the regime in Lebanon and to install a puppet government. That was the aim of Ariel Sharon's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, he says. It failed, but Sharon and his pupils in the military and political leadership have never really given up on it. As in 1982, the present operation, too, was planned and is being carried out in full coordination with the U.S. As then, there is no doubt that it is coordinated with a part of the Lebanese elite. That's the main thing. Everything else is noise and propaganda. End quote. On the other front, in Gaza, the idea that whatever the fate of the captive soldier Gilad Shalit may be, the Israeli army's war in Gaza is not about him, was confirmed by security analyst Alex Fishman, writing in Yediat Aharonot. Fishman, who favors the elimination of Hamas, says that the army was preparing for an attack months earlier and was constantly pushing for it, with the goal of destroying the Hamas infrastructure and its government. The abduction of the soldier released the safety catch, and the operation began on the 28th of June with the destruction of infrastructure in Gaza and the mass detention of the Hamas leadership in the West Bank, which was also planned weeks in advance. Ismail Haniya expressed much the same idea a week later in an article for the Washington Post. Corporal Shalit, he said, is only a pretext for a job scheduled months ago. Karen Kwiatkowski, a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel, recalls the strategic vision in a paper written for Benjamin Netanyahu by Richard Perle and a number of influential American neoconservatives. She argues that that paper, called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, is the key to understanding Israel's current security policy. Back in Beirut, Fisk points out that in past violence of this kind, Syria's power was controlled by Hafez Assad, one of the shrewdest Arabs in modern history. But there are those, including Lebanese politicians, who believe that Bashar, the son, lacks his late father's wisdom and understanding of power. Similar questions have been raised about Ehud Olmert. Writing in the conservative Jerusalem Post, David Horowitz says, "Many outside commentators have loudly wondered over the weekend whether a government led by military veterans such as Ariel Sharon or Yitzhak Rabin would have responded to Hezbollah's cross-border onslaught last Wednesday in the way that Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz have. The answer, he concludes, is almost certainly yes. A more challenging question, according to Horovitz, is whether Nasrallah would have dared authorize the attack had a Sharon or Rabin been in power. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert is not well known outside Israel. At 60, he is a lifelong politician who was first elected to the Knesset at 28. He officially became prime minister in April, but had been the acting PM since January when his mentor, Ariel Sharon, suffered a massive stroke and was incapacitated. Even those who hated Ariel Sharon recognized him as a rare individual, especially so when compared to others in that small group of generals who try their hand at politics. He was a far better general than, say, Colin Powell, brilliant, idiosyncratic, equivocal, brutal, and he was a successful politician. One thinks of Eisenhower, de Gaulle. He got away with frequent acts of insubordination and deceit against his superiors. Although he was forced to resign as defense minister after the inquiry into Sabra and Shatila, he was still the individual who made facts on the ground a household phrase. On the other hand, Ehud Olmert is a municipal politician who inherited the master's most ambitious endgame. His military training, especially when compared with almost every other Israeli leader, has been brief. He was injured during his compulsory military service and released early. He completed his military duties as a journalist for the Armed Forces magazine and was a military correspondent during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. However, speaking of Israel's other prime ministers, Time magazine describes Olmert as probably the best politician of them all. A lawyer, a deal-maker, and an inside man, he is a former finance minister and minister of trade and development. He spent two terms as mayor of Jerusalem, concentrating on development and transit issues. As mayor of Jerusalem between 1993 and 2003, he advocated expanding settlements in the West Bank surrounding the city. His Israel is a modern democratic society, not a biblical reenactment. He calculated that Israel couldn't rule the Palestinians in Gaza and remain a democracy. In November 2003, he gave a speech foreshadowing Sharon's disengagement plan. Soon after, he gave his views in an interview. Quote, "We are approaching the point where more and more Palestinians will say, we have been won over. We agree with Lieberman. There is no room for two states between the Jordan River and the sea. All we want is the right to vote. The day they do that is the day we will lose everything," Olmert said. "Even when they carry out terror, it is very difficult for us to persuade the world of the justice of our cause. We see this on a daily basis, all the more so when there is only one demand, an equal right to vote. The thought that the struggle against us will be headed by liberal Jewish organizations who shouldered the burden of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa scares me." End quote. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert speaking in 2003. Olmert lacks the military experience to get away with floating like a butterfly, so we probably will see a lot of stinging like a bee. That can have a devastating effect on the home folks, especially if the war isn't over quickly. Israeli actions in Gaza and Lebanon seem to be similarly designed. In both cases, air and artillery attacks were first unleashed to cut transportation routes and cordon off key areas. The army is now moving in to tighten the noose. In fact, these are textbook invasions. The generals are in charge. The most obvious problem with this kind of maneuver is the civilians killed in bombardments or cut off from supplies like water and food. Olmert may be politically savvy enough not to dismiss civilian deaths as collateral damage, but to understand them as a terminal liability in fighting fourth-generation war. That's it for this Monday. This edition of World Report has been archived on the World Report website at cjly.net/worldreport. You can get it either as a podcast or in raw MP3 format. There is also a link to a text version of the broadcast. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjly.net or by snail mail to Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.
You know you only had one shot to make it right. to do the right thing, so listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
The Last Throes of Iraq. This is Jav Parrish. For the past week, the news has been abuzz with the developments in the Middle East, and with good reason. But Lebanon is not the only enormous story unfolding in the Middle East. The last 2 weeks have seen the situation in Baghdad degenerate into all-out civil war. If allowed to take hold, such violence virtually guarantees not only that Iraq's current government will fail, but that Iraq itself will disintegrate as a unified nation-state. That's the story being dwarfed by Lebanon. In the first 4 days of last week, over 160 Iraqi civilians were killed by sectarian fighting in the Baghdad area alone. Sunni and Shia militias massacred civilians in each other's neighborhoods, while Iraqi and American troops stood by helplessly. By air, bus, taxi, even on foot, Iraqis are fleeing Baghdad and their country as fast as they can. The educated classes have mostly abandoned Iraq in recent months. Now, all kinds of Iraqis in large numbers are fleeing for their lives, creating an enormous refugee crisis. What are they fleeing? The Times of London reported last week that, quote, West Baghdad is no stranger to bombings and killings, but in the past few days, all restraint has vanished in an orgy of ethnic cleansing, end quote. Militias are systematically terrorizing the targeted Shia or Sunnis to leave ethnically mixed neighborhoods. Those who don't are killed. Riverbend, the young Iraqi woman whose blog Baghdad Burning has become an essential window into Iraq outside the Green Zone, writes of the current crisis, quote, life here has become unbearable because it's no longer a life like people live abroad. It's simply a matter of survival, making it from one day to the next in one piece and coping with the loss of loved ones and friends. So what is the United States doing about this American-created catastrophe? Nothing. Back here in Lotus Land, amazingly, there is no serious political discussion about what to do in Iraq. Not for the long term, nor in response to the immediate crises. Bush wants to stay the course, which is like the car plunging off the cliff while its driver, halfway down, pledges not to turn the steering wheel. Republicans mostly follow the White House and duck the topic. Democrats, with the honorable exception of John Murtha and a few others, have been just as bad. They know Americans widely consider Iraq to be a mistake and a disaster, and they'd like to reap the electoral windfall come November without any irritating distractions, such as, say, discussions about what to do now. They won't get off that easily. If it was ever an option, it isn't any longer. Events in Lebanon, as well as Baghdad, are demanding that Democrats come up with a coherent foreign policy that is more specific and nuanced than saying, me too, or they did that, not us. This is not a political game we're talking about here. It's the lives and futures of millions of people trapped by an illegal and immoral American invasion and the passions it has unleashed. The politicians of both U.S. parties who created, signed off on, and largely still endorse this catastrophe are doing what exactly about it? And if this is what they're doing about the horrific civilian carnage in Iraq, why should we trust any of them to have a constructive response to the even larger Middle East crisis, now threatening to engulf us all? From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's gonna happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not being standing. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. I can, but I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people,
greatest threat. Terrorists, dangerous, die. In turn, murders.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, July 24th, 2006, 2,561 United States military personnel have died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 18,999 United States military personnel have been wounded, over 9,000 of which have suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 227 other coalition forces have also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
And now, the man who doesn't misrepresent evidence to the UN, Mike Cannon.
Okay, sticking with war, which is not hard since they're popping up all over the place. The following is by Guerrilla Radio out of Washington, D.C., and the home of protest of war criminal and NSA spying mastermind John Negroponte at his 3100 Cleveland Avenue home on his 67th birthday last week. D.C. Guerrilla Radio were also reporting from near a park outside the White House where Bring the Troops Home Fast is happening. This anti-war fast has been happening since July 4th. After that, to the top of the hour, we'll change gears a little and have a 5-minute Media Minutes produced out of Illinois. That's what you get each Monday starting at 2 p.m. on this Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio show for Central Wisconsin. Non-corporate voices from around the country and the world. Hope you've enjoyed them, and thanks for listening.
On Friday, the 21st of July, protesters returned to 3100 Cleveland Avenue, the home of the notorious war criminal John Negroponte. When John Negroponte was U.S. ambassador to Honduras during the Ronald Reagan years, he helped his buddy General Alvarez set up the Death Squad Battalion 316 that murdered thousands of people by dropping them into the ocean from helicopters with their legs encased in concrete. University professors, union activists, nuns, many others fell victim to Battalion 316. But General Alvarez is no more, and now protesters are coming to the home of John Negroponte.
Generals gathered in the masses, just like witches at black masses. Minds and plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
John Negroponte began his career during the Vietnam War, but was thrown out of Vietnam for being so far to the right of Henry Kissinger that Kissinger wouldn't work with him. He was exiled to Ecuador, and that set up his later ambassadorship in Honduras, where he was involved in death squad activity. Can't hide from us. Sound of a large and angry protest in front of John Negroponte's home. Where are the disappeared indeed, John Negroponte? Are they in your basement at 3100 Cleveland Avenue? Are they in your basement, John? Or swimming with the fishes off the coast of Honduras? Indeed, John Negroponte is becoming like the neighborhood child molester, hated by his neighbors, seen in suspicion everywhere. At one point, halfway through the protest, his wife emerged from his home and sarcastically tried to stir the crowd up, taking a severe risk in the process. But no one took the bait and nothing happened.
Murderers are welcome here! Murderers are welcome here! Murderers are welcome here!
This protest took effect on the John Negroponte's 67th birthday, 21st of July. Thousands of people no longer get to celebrate their birthdays thanks to John Negroponte. So his 67th birthday present was a storm of protesters outside his home at 3100 Cleveland Avenue Northwest.
Negroponte, stop the lying!
Negroponte, stop the spying!
Negroponte, stop the spying!
Negroponte, stop the crime!
Negroponte, stop the crime!
Negroponte, obey the conventions!
Negroponte, obey the conventions!
We are here this afternoon to say that on the 67th birthday of this man, John Dimitri Negroponte, we are here for the voiceless. We are here for the ones who are being tortured at this very minute as a result of the policies of the U.S. government, which are very much promoted by John Dimitri Negroponte. We are here parallel to what is happening in Peace Park, in Lafayette Park, with the troops home fast. We believe that the troops must come home fast. We also believe that fasting is, as Gandhi said, the prayer of a soul in anguish. And we are here in support of our sisters and our brothers who are fasting. There are more than 4,000 strong, and there are two of us who are fasting just on water.
And that is, of course, a representative of the troops out fast, being carried out in Lafayette Park in front of the White House, speaking at the rally at John Negroponte's home on the occasion of his 67th birthday up at 3100 Cleveland Avenue Northwest.
This is day 17, and the invasion of Lebanon and the call for the renunciation, the resignation of John Negroponte, and the call to end the war in Iraq and the occupation, these are all the same call for justice and peace. John Negroponte represents the most fascistic part of this administration. He is a man who was to the right wing of Henry Kissinger during the Vietnam War. He is the one who opposed the Paris peace talks in the early 1970s. And Kissinger then kicked him to where? To Ecuador, to like the Siberia of the diplomatic corps. But then he showed his true nature, his right-wing character, and who promoted him to ambassador? Ronald Reagan.
Ooh.
And what happened in Honduras when he was ambassador? U.S. military aid went up from $3 million to $77 million a year. This man is a man of militarizing. He's a man of violence. He is a man who needs to be denounced. And what we are doing now in the tradition of Uruguay, in the tradition of Argentina, is called an escrache. Yes! Say, let's get it all you have for the escraches in all of Latin America and in North America! What is an escrache? They took the word all of these decades. We are here to say, Negro Ponte Asesino!
Negro Ponte Asesino!
Negro Ponte, stop rendition!
Negro Ponte, stop rendition!
Negro Ponte, stop terrorism!
Negro Ponte, stop terrorism!
Negro Ponte, stop invasion!
Negro Ponte, stop invasion!
Ponte, go to trial!
Negro Ponte, go to trial!
Negro Ponte, face a life sentence!
Negro Ponte, face a life sentence!
Negro Ponte! Support the World Court of Justice!
Support
the World Court of Justice! We support the International Criminal Court, which is what could bring this man to trial. And of course, the United States doesn't want to be charged with war crimes, and so they oppose the existence of the court. But we say yes to the International Criminal Court. We say yes to the Geneva Conventions. Negro Ponte, stop the violations!
Negro Ponte, stop the violations!
Negro Ponte, respect autonomy!
Negro Ponte, respect autonomy!
Negro Ponte, leave your job!
Negro Ponte, leave your job!
Negro Ponte, leave DC!
DC! Negro Ponte, leave DC! Negro Ponte, leave DC!
He helped establish Battalion 316. Battalion 316 is a death squad. And what did the media call the policies that were being taken to Iraq when Negro Ponte was the ambassador there? They said the Salvador option had come to Iraq. And who brought it there? John Dimitri Negro Ponte. This is a man of death squads. This is a man of torture. And this is the man who holds the most powerful position in the international, in the intelligence community, so-called, in this country. This is a man who brought over the head of the NSA, who was the strongest supporter of domestic espionage in violation of the Constitution, to become the head of the CIA. This is a man who is co-opting power more and more and moving this country toward a military and fascist dictatorship.
When do we want it?
John Dimitri Negro Ponte. This man is a man of deceit, a man of lies. Justice! Now!
Justice! Now!
John Negro Ponte is a wanted man in many nations, and now the whole world knows about the dark secret at 3100 Cleveland Avenue where Negro Ponte sleeps at night.
Negro Ponte, get it right! We know where you sleep at night! Negro Ponte, get it right! We know where you sleep at night!
Now in darkness world stops turning, as he's where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and the God has struck the hour. Day of judgment, God is calling. Underneath the war pigs crawling, begging mercy for their sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh Lord, yeah.
John Negro Ponte, you can't hide from the people of this earth. You certainly can't hide at 3100 Cleveland Avenue. Everybody knows where you live. History has shown that no matter what country they take refuge in, war criminals are eventually found and brought to justice.
No sleep for the wicked.
And sit back, relax. Breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On July 17th, the so-called father and grandfather of the Internet squared off in a debate over the principle of network neutrality. Vint Cerf, who developed the network protocols on which the Internet functions and is now chief Internet evangelist for Google, and Dave Farber, former FCC chief technologist and professor of computer science and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University, held forth in front of an audience at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Cerf spoke eloquently as to why data discrimination based on wealth would destroy the democratic nature of the Internet. And Farber, who's been labeled the grandfather of the Internet by phone and cable companies because he advised many scientists who later went on to work on the Internet, agreed with him. In fact, one did not get the sense from listening to Farber that he's actually opposed to network neutrality. Whereas opponents to network neutrality assure us that any instances of data discrimination could be easily addressed by the FCC, Farber did not agree.
Its responses can be challenged in the courts, and things can be strung out, and the regulatory mechanisms become part of your competitive edge.
When questioned about the comments of AT&T CEO Ed Whitaker and others who claim they have a right to extract more money from Internet users of all shapes and sizes because they own key parts of the U.S. broadband network infrastructure, Farber did not agree.
It is beyond me why Whitaker actually stirred up this hornet's nest. Reading his past history, he's not a sort of wild card, and yet I don't understand the reason for it.
In fact, both Cerf and Farber recognized a need for some sort of legal guarantee that phone and cable companies would not use their duopoly over broadband connectivity to restrict access to information online. And although the phone and cable companies that have used Farber as a foil to fight network neutrality don't like the idea of any government involvement in the issue, Farber does not agree.
The focus of this should not be, in my opinion, protecting companies against companies. It should be protecting the users against companies in general.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the head of the Senate Commerce Committee, Ted Stevens, is turning to phone and cable companies for help to push telecom legislation that lacks a net neutrality guarantee toward a vote on the Senate floor. Aides for the Alaska Republican held a big meeting earlier this month with industry lobbyists and asked them to go to every senator and perform some reconnaissance on their feelings for Internet freedom. A vote on the Stevens bill is not expected now until September at the earliest.
The battle for network neutrality here may have repercussions felt around the world. Borrowing talking points from the chiefs of AT&T and Verizon, who want a double charge for the information that flows through their networks, Germany's Deutsche Telekom is calling on German and European Union regulators to allow data discrimination on the company's new fiber optic network, which forms the backbone for a service that provides nearly 10 times the amount of bandwidth compared to what U.S. phone and cable companies currently offer. If it's not allowed to discriminate, Deutsche Telekom says it might halt network upgrades and lay off a slew of workers. Telecom executives in Italy are making similar noises. But at least one member of the European Union Information Society has responded to these threats by noting that just because broadband is now in vogue does not mean that it's proper to, quote, establish new monopolies on the basis of old ones. Just last month, the European Commission issued a strong statement in support of a non-discriminatory online environment. For what it's worth, British and France Telecom are both on record in support of the principle of network neutrality, though it's not written down anywhere in their policies. Because the Internet is actually a patchwork of different networks, a loss of net neutrality here will be felt overseas. U.S. lawmakers thus have a chance not only to preserve Internet freedom at home, but abroad as well, by setting the tone for global debate on the issue.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. The media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has conducted its yearly survey of think tanks in the media. For the first time FAIR began its analysis, the number of citations to think tanks declined last year. However, when the political leanings of each think tank are considered, a media bias can be seen, and it's not of the liberal persuasion. Of the 27,229 think tank citations made by major newspapers, radio, and television stations last year, 47% went to centrist groups, 40% were attributed to conservative institutions, while just 13% came from progressive organizations. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You've been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio.